As we all know, choosy mothers are very concerned about what peanut butter they buy.
Nutritious. That describes every peanut butter, because they all have about the same nutrition. But one stands out from the rest. It's not only nutritious, it's more.
Lots more, right. Some peanut butter can make you really sick. The recent salmonella contamination, it turns out, is neither recent nor terribly unusual. When the federal government drops the ball on food safety, it's hard to know anything.
For delicious peanut taste.
Peanutty good.
The feds, not so choosy mothers, as it turns out, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 23rd, and when it comes to peanut butter, well, the lawsuits have already started.
That's
we'll have that story today,
That's
John.
Right. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning to you, John, and good morning to you, everyone. New York gets a new senator, Kirsten Gillibrand. We'll tell you about her. We're also going to talk about that lawsuit, as well as the opening of the movie Slumdog Millionaire. Not the opening here in the U.S. It's already gotten an Oscar nomination. Now it's opening in India. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
As Adora just said, New York will soon have a new junior senator. Kirsten Gillibrand will take Hillary Clinton's old seat. As Democrats go, Gillibrand is on the more conservative wing of the party. At least she represents a conservative district in the upstate of New York. This is the same seat Caroline Kennedy sought and then withdrew from. We'll talk more about the significance of the pick in just a moment. No such luck for Minnesota on the Senate issue. A drawn-out legal fight over the election results means it will only have one senator for a while. A new court ruling means the case begins on Monday. Al Franken's lawyer says Norm Coleman is just fishing for votes.
They have to hope to find some category of ballots and then hope that when they open that category of ballots, they find some cache of votes that will allow them to make up what is right now a fairly comfortable lead of 225 votes.
Comfortable after out of 3 million ballots cast in the state of Minnesota? I don't know. As for Norm Coleman's legal team, they see that count as more of a rough draft. Here's Ben Ginsburg, the Coleman attorney.
The fact of the matter is there is no valid vote now in Minnesota. It is at best a preliminary vote. And we believe, looking at the ballots that will come in, that when they're all counted, Norm Coleman will be seated as the next United States senator.
Well, you'll have to stay tuned. The court case means it's going to take weeks to figure this out.
Meanwhile, Senate business goes on, though, and President Obama's cabinet is coming together. Senators have now confirmed Republican Ray LaHood as transportation secretary, as well as Sean Donovan as housing secretary. Several big posts are still open, though. Tim Geithner is expected to win confirmation as treasury secretary on Monday. Attorney General nominee Eric Holder still faces hurdles. President Obama is also hiring two veteran diplomats as special envoys to troubled regions. Former Senator George Mitchell will be the Mideast envoy. A lasting peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians will be a top priority. Former UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke will serve as envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the Dow lost 1.3% yesterday, closing at 81.22. The S&P both dropped 1.5%, ending at 827, and oil is around $43 a barrel today.
Well, Barack Obama is keeping his BlackBerry after a crisis over whether it's a national security issue. How would you text him if you could? A very restricted number of people are going to have that opportunity. A text message to the president. Give him a smiley. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Smiley.
Smiley. Frowny.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. President Obama had a second busy day in office yesterday. He immediately named a special envoy to the Middle East and another one to Afghanistan and Pakistan, making it clear foreign policy is a priority. He named the former U.N. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke to oversee relations with Afghanistan, and then he chose former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell to the Middle East spot. Mitchell's been credited with brokering peace in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants. That was under President Clinton's administration. We're joined by Daniel Levy, Levy, director of the Middle East Initiative at the New America Foundation, for his take. Daniel was also a member of the official Israel negotiating team at the Oslo talks in 1995. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Adora.
Well, clearly, George Mitchell is a well-seasoned diplomat. Is he the right person for the job at the right time?
I think a lot of people are feeling encouraged today that the prospects for real progress in Middle East peace talks will be enhanced by having George Mitchell there. First of all, this is the first time in 8 years that there has been an American peace envoy at all. And he didn't shirk away from outlining an ambitious agenda, George Mitchell, when he was introduced yesterday. He reminded people of the work he'd done in Northern Ireland, and he actually came forward and said, look, I don't think there's any conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are made by human beings. They can be resolved by human beings.
Indeed. We actually have those exact words. Let's listen. It's very quick.
There is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, and sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings.
There was a lot of conviction there in his voice. What has been the reaction?
Well, first of all, I think the Middle East, the region, Israelis and Palestinians have looked at an incoming president. They heard him on the campaign trail as a candidate saying, this is a priority, this is an American interest, and I'm going to deal with this from day one in office. Not what we saw under the Bush administration, where there were 7 years of neglect, and then in the very last year, a really haphazard effort to try and advance peace. And they've wondered, okay, are we actually going to see something? And they saw a president who, on his second day, went to the State Department, made this announcement. George Mitchell then appears, spoke about his commitment to seeing things through, and then went into some detail regarding the immediate Gaza crisis on what needs to happen in a ceasefire package, not only the ending of hostilities, not only the prevention of weapon smuggling, but also the fact that Gaza needs to be opened up. There needs to be access of materials into and out of Gaza. So I think people in the region are looking at President Obama. By the way, of course, the region also listens very closely when the announcements are made over the closure of Guantanamo Bay, when the announcements are made, of course, regarding Iraq. And I think the Middle East is looking at a president who right now seems incredibly serious about advancing the kind of agenda he discussed as a candidate. And I think people are waiting to see what happens next. Senator Mitchell will visit the region in the coming days, I understand, within a week or two. And people, I think, are looking and saying, this is someone who's quite serious about moving forward.
How important do you think it is? From what I understand, Mitchell is very close to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And if there is going to be some resolution in the Middle East, it's got to be clear that the U.S. is acting, everyone is on the same page, acting in the same way. So how critical is it that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Mitchell, and the president were all there yesterday, today, and seemingly have very good relations?
And, of course, the Vice President, Adora, not to forget him. I think that's absolutely critical, Adora. The key for someone in this kind of a position is to be empowered, is for the parties in the region to know that when this person gets on the phone, when this person shows up, they're there on behalf of the President and the Secretary of State. And Mitchell's own experience will tell him how important that is. When George Mitchell was the island envoy, he made incredible advances and breakthroughs. He developed a process in Ireland. He brought in the hardliners. It was an inclusive approach. It was a patient approach. But everyone knew that he spoke on behalf of President Clinton. Later on, as his last mission in the Middle East, George Mitchell ran a fact-finding commission to look into why there was an outbreak of violence. He produced an impeccably serious report, really the gold standard on what should have happened to end the violence in 2001. But people knew then that he was not speaking on behalf of President Bush. The report was not used, and unfortunately the violence went on for many years. So it's absolutely crucial.
Although, Daniel Levy, I mean, as much as it's nice to think optimistically about the situation in Gaza, I mean, it's not as though the Oslo process that you were a part of, was sustainable in any sense. I mean, this is a serious challenge that George Mitchell faces, and no amount of kind of glad-handing or a sense of anticipation about Barack Obama is going to make this work. there are serious issues with the break within the Palestinians, and even the Israelis and even people very close to the region say the mechanism for bringing the Palestinians into a unified front is very difficult to see. You had Muammar Gaddafi yesterday talking for a one-state solution in Israel as the only solution, that two-state is dead.
Of course, you're right, John, that this is no one suggesting that this is going to be an easy mission. The situation in the Middle East is much more difficult than it was. It's radically destabilized. However, I would argue the following. First of all, hope is also a precious commodity that can be translated into a security and political currency as well. If people believe that there's a new options available, that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think your point is well taken, that you need a break from the existing flawed policies. There's been a peace process which hasn't brought in the people who need to be involved. You can't just do this with the Palestinians you're friendly with. You're going to have to also involve the Palestinians who are on the outside, the ones who have the ability to bring down a process. So I think there's an existing process, but it needs to be fundamentally rethought. And that's why I think people are not expecting a breakthrough tomorrow.
Certainly not a breakthrough coming tomorrow. Daniel Levy, director of the New America Foundation's Middle East Envoy, talking about President Obama's pick as a Middle East envoy in George Mitchell. Thank you.
Well, it was a triumph when Kirsten Gillibrand won the Republican conservative upstate seat here in New York in Congress back in 2006. What would we call it that she was named early this morning as by David Paterson, the governor of New York, to be the senator replacing Hillary Clinton? Joining us now to talk about the ascension, the rapid ascension of Kirsten Gillibrand is Liz Benjamin, reporter for the New York Daily News, who covered the Gillibrand congressional race for the New York Daily News. And now she's a much bigger figure, but most people in New York don't really know her, right, Liz?
That's true. She's largely unknown to people outside the 20th Congressional District, which is the district she represents.
So she used to be called, when she grew up in Albany, Tina Rutnick. She's a very changed individual now and known for being conservative because she has to survive in a conservative district. Do you think her conservatism translates statewide and into the Senate under the sort of era of Barack Obama?
I think she's going to have a very tough time of it, actually. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party is already signaling its intent to challenge her. The liberals are very upset. She's a blue dog Democrat. Oddly, when she first ran in 06, I covered her for the Albany Times Union, she had to argue and make the case that she was not a liberal carpetbagger from New York City. She had just relocated back to the region after a stint in Manhattan. So, you know, she really remade herself in a district where there's an 80,000-plus GOP enrollment edge, and she is more of conservative, and that's going to be a problem in a Democratic primary where the downstate dominance is key.
Well, it may be a problem for her, but what does this play for Governor David Paterson, who, if he wants to run for governor, needs the upstate? Does this give him any creds upstate?
Well, yes and no. I mean, of course, he tapped an upstate woman, which is a ticket balancing move, and he's never run statewide before for this particular position. He was Elliot Spitzer's lieutenant governor pick. But yes, it has cred if she makes it on the ticket. She has to win the primary, and already you have at least two people saying that they're going to challenge her. So if she doesn't make it through the primary, she won't be on the ticket to balance anything for David Paterson.
And all of that is 2 years in the future. What do you think Kirsten Gillibrand brings to the Senate right now?
Well, that's interesting. She is an unusually aggressive politician, despite the fact that she has this sort of appearance of sort of soft. She's connected to Hillary Clinton. She worked on Clinton's 2000 campaign. She is astute. She is very shrewd. And I think that she is going to work incredibly hard, and she raises money very well.
Now, it's interesting because the suspicion when Caroline Kennedy was going for this position was that she would be a massive fundraiser. As a fundraiser, is it something that works just in the state, or is it something that could extend nationally?
Raised money outside the state with some help from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The seat's very important to the Democrats.
All right. Well, we're introducing you all and the takeaway to Kirsten Gillibrand, the new senator from the state of New York, appointed by David Paterson. Liz Benjamin, reporter for the Daily News. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's only week one for President Obama, but it appears he's already won at least one argument, and that was with the Secret Service about keeping his BlackBerry. So now he gets to keep his BlackBerry,
and he gets
a little short list of friends and people that he can text back and forth with or send email back and forth with. If you were one of those people, what would be the message that you would send to him? Would you say something like, I don't know, dear Mr. President, when you get a chance, would you mind cutting my taxes a little bit?
No. I got one.
That would be a good one.
Here's a text. Joe Biden, TMI.
Too much information.
Lay off TMI or something like
that. Right. Well, what would you send if you could? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So it's a hot, happening day in India today. Outside of Hollywood, nobody watches the Oscars and the sort of movie business more than people in India, and they're definitely paying attention to the movie Slumdog Millionaire, which was just nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Film and Best Director. It opens today, that movie does, in cinemas across India. It's set in the city of Mumbai, follows the fortunes of a young man from the slums who has a chance to hit the jackpot on the Indian version of a television quiz show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And the movie is, first of all, already a global sensation, but the fact that it's opening up in India is pretty darn exciting. Malini Agarwal joins us from Radio 1 Mumbai. Malini, this is a big, big deal in Mumbai today, right?
Absolutely. I think it's also such a matter of pride for everyone that we're back in the Oscar at the Oscars. I mean, we've been nominated in the past for films like Mother India, Salaam Bombay and Lagan, and taken home prizes with Lifetime Achievements for Satyajit Ray and costume design. But this time, the fact that it's a story about Bombay, it doesn't really matter if it's a Bollywood film or not. There's a sense of pride and ownership to the film that everybody here feels.
Well, let's talk about that pride, because it's a sophisticated pride. They're sick of the Lifetime Achievement Awards and the Best Foreign Film. All that sort of malarkey award. They want the big ones, right?
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that there have been so many films made locally in Bollywood about the slums and what happens and people who overcome great difficulty from the slums and achieve great heights, even like true stories. And so we've seen that. So actually a lot of the sentiment is that it's not a new story, but it's been edited so beautifully and presented so well that it's finally a chance for the story that we've been wanting the world to see done and presented in a way that everybody's able to appreciate it.
I mean, I think it's clear, and listen to this clip, that this is a moment of heroic joy for the Chaiwalas everywhere.
A few hours ago, you were giving chai for the Phonewalas, and now you're richer than they will ever be. Walla player. Ladies and gentlemen, Walla player!
Of course, there, the moment in Slumdog Millionaire where the Chaiwala becomes richer than he could ever have imagined. Is that a story that resonates there in Mumbai? And are there actually Chaiwalas, people who hand out tea in offices, who will be going to this movie and feeling like it speaks directly to them?
If that would be the case, although they are doing a Bollywood, a Hindi version, so they'll be able to understand. So it's Slumdog Crorepati, which will be translated. But I think the interesting thing is, and I mean, if you haven't watched a movie in India, you'll be very surprised to hear this, but it's true that very often people, when they know what the plot is like and if the story is over, they'll get up and walk out before the credits. But there was a premiere yesterday, and they actually sat through all the credits, which is a big deal, and there was a lot of whistling and clapping and dancing in the aisles. And some of my friends who went, I'm actually going today to see it, were quite surprised to see this reaction. election. So it's actually appealed to a whole range, and although it tells the story of a regular guy, I think the fact that reality TV is suddenly so big as well in Bombay and India, it is the story of the real man, the real struggle, and just something that is very relatable, and the fact that you have watched shows like Kaun Banega Crorepati, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, day after day, and see people's lives change. It's just a really good feel-good film that, you know, it gives you a sense of hope in a realistic environment.
Now, there are some stars in the movie that are legitimate Hollywood stars, but a mega hit in Mumbai is a very high bar. I mean, I think the numbers of people that go to see movies are absolutely huge in India, and a hit is when people see it like seven or eight times, not just when they see it once.
Absolutely, because it is sort of the poor man's, you know, 3 hours of escape, a film of this nature, of any kind of film is usually that way. Now, Anil Kapoor, to his credit, I mean, everybody knows him as Mr. India because he was in a film called Mr. India, which he's a sort of a superhero. And he sort of had, you know, lived out his time and people had started to forget about him, but he's definitely back now. And more than anything, more than a particular character, I think the film on the whole encompasses a feeling that it's Bombay. So especially in the city, it's you see places that you recognize. And also in light of everything that happened on 26/11, people feel very protective about the city. So it's I think it's a combination of all these things, and it's quite clever that it's releasing just about the time where the Oscar nominations have come out, so there's even more interest. And A.R. Rahman is a legend. Everyone loved his music here right from when he started his career with a film called Roja. And he's such a humble, down-to-earth, lovely, talented human being.
No, they're great. It's a great cast. It's a fantastic cast. Melanie, I want to bring it down personally, though, to you, okay? Can you answer this question? Listen to this.
In the chair tonight is Jamal Malik. As if we don't know.
For 10 million rupees.
The question once again. Which cricketer has scored the most first-class centuries in history?
Melanie Agarwal, are Indians going to scream out the answer in the movie theater today?
I'm sure they will scream out the answer, but I'll only answer if you're actually going to give me the money.
Very smart woman from Radio 1 Mumbai, Melanie Agarwal, talking about the premiere of Slumdog Millionaire today in Mumbai. And opening our studio, the headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Grim economic news from major companies like Microsoft and news that Britain had fallen into recession have sent international stock markets sliding today. Every major market in Asia retreated, with Japan's Nikkei benchmark tumbling almost 4%. European markets are down between 1 and 3%. The Dow futures are down nearly more than 1.5% before the opening. Democratic Congresswoman Kirsten Gillibrand is the New York governor's pick to fill Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's vacant Senate seat. An aide to the governor says Gillibrand will be formally named later today. President Barack Obama's cabinet is getting full, but his pick for Attorney General remains mired in questions over interrogation methods. A hearing on Eric Holden's nomination to hold the Justice Department, to head the Justice Department, has been delayed until Tuesday. It's been called the BlackBerry, the unhackable smartphone that the president will be using while in office. The National Security Agency has approved the $3,000 phone, but any email sent from it has to be preserved by law. Here's the White House Press Secretary, Robert Gibbs, talking about the president's messages.
They're all subject to the Presidential Records Act. There are, as you know, some narrow exemptions in the Presidential Records Act to afford for strictly personal communications.
So it's Gibbs, actually.
Oh, Gibbs.
No, it's Gibbs, actually, but it's Gillibrand, the senator.
Okay. Thank you. There, I stand corrected.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You got to wonder what presidential historians are thinking about Barack Obama's decision to keep his BlackBerry and to be able to text a small circle of friends with private messages.
Sounds dangerous, actually, I think.
Well, I guess the question of forwarding or viruses,
correct.
Who knows? There are probably hackers out there trying to figure it out.
Are you kidding? That's a huge, like, mission now. I've just issued a massive challenge to them.
Hackers and presidential historians are interested, but what about you? What's a text message you would send to the new president?
I would text President Obama with the following in all caps, WINDNRGTX2ND, to give him a heads up that placing a network of wind farms in the Plain States could be the future energy solution for America.
And that's probably why he's limiting it to a small circle of friends. But what would you text to Obama or any leader, Hillary Clinton, David Patterson, Vladimir Putin, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org? That was great.
It was a good one. The first lawsuit tied to the recent salmonella outbreak in some brands of peanut butter was filed just this week. Overall, the salmonella-tainted peanut butter has sickened, apparently, close to 500 people in 43 states, and it's blamed for 6 deaths. The outbreak started in September, but the FDA only recently pinpointed the source, which they say stems from King Nut brand peanut butter made by the Peanut Corporation of America in Georgia. Since then, more than 125 products have been canceled. Joining us is Bill Marler, a Seattle lawyer who's representing the family suing and advises companies on food safety. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So what happened to your clients?
Well, I represent about 30 people nationwide who are part of this outbreak. They're tied to the genetic fingerprint of the Salmonella typhimurium bacteria, so they're part of the nearly 500 people counted. And, you know, unfortunately, the illnesses range from being sick for a few days to a death. And, you know, unfortunately, again, we're just seeing another one of these recalls. And unfortunately, again, it's another, you know, salmonella-related recall to peanut butter.
Bill, what took so long to pinpoint the exact source? I mean, this is an investigation that's been going on for months.
Well, it really comes down to a failure in our public health system. You know, it starts at the emergency rooms, you know, sort of our first responders in the United States, pediatricians, people who go into ERs and their pediatrician's office, some without insurance, don't get stool cultures, even though they're exhibiting signs of a bacterial or viral disease. So a lot of the people who should be counted as part of this outbreak don't get counted. And the CDC estimates that for every one person counted, there's about 40 people who are actually part of this outbreak who are not counted. So when you miss that many people, the system doesn't catch on quick enough that there's an outbreak going on. So in essence, the CDC, FDA, and local and state health departments, when there's a nationwide outbreak, are just not seeing what's really happening. And so that's in part why it takes so long to try, in a sense, triangulate to what the likely product is that's causing people to become sick and die.
So much of the responsibility then for checking the food is left to the companies from what you've just described. And just to note, Peanut Corporation of America, that's the company that makes the King Nut brand, issued this statement saying, quote, "We deeply regret that this product recall has expanded, and our first priority is to protect the health of our customers." So are they only at fault, or is it a combination of what they've done and the lack of oversight by the FDA and the Agriculture Department and the other regulatory agencies?
If you kind of go back to how FDA regulates many companies in the United States, it's likely that this particular plant and, frankly, most manufacturing facilities that make, you know, our food products might get inspected once every 2 or 3 years. They just simply don't have the manpower to do checks, and then they're quite, you know, they're not very detailed. So when the peanut butter outbreak happened in ConAgra, the ConAgra Peter Pan peanut butter in 2007, the FDA had not been in that plant for 2 years earlier, And when they were there, had learned, the FDA itself had learned that there had been positive salmonella tests, asked for the results. The company said no, contact corporate headquarters, and the FDA never even contacted them. So it's these outbreaks happen because of a combination of failures. They expand primarily because of a failure of our public health system, you know, to catch them early enough to give the CDC adequate information.
In Minnesota, experts there were the ones to pinpoint the problem with this peanut butter. And you say that that system in Minnesota really is a model for the rest of the country. What did they do right?
Well, Minnesota, their health department, their epidemiologists, affectionately known as Team Diarrhea, they're actually sort of dedicated to figuring out foodborne illnesses in all sorts of diarrheal illnesses. They have a system in place where the epidemiologists are in very close contact with what I would call their first responders, the ER doctors, the pediatricians. They know quite early on, more so than any other state in the country, early on they know what the problems are, and then they're able to go and, you know, communicate with the victims. So they're catching these things, getting enough data points where they can really figure out, you know, why these outbreaks are happening. This is something that other states actually need to model. The, you know, CDC needs to model this. Minnesota figures out most of the outbreaks that occur in the United States, and, you know, frankly, they're just a, you know, relatively small state in the scheme of things.
Bill Marler, we thank you for joining us this morning.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Bill Marler is a Seattle lawyer who's representing the family suing the company responsible, the FDA says, for the recent outbreak of salmonella related to peanut butter. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you very much. Time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama has appointed new special envoys to deal with two of the world's most troubled places. Former Maine Senator George Mitchell will take charge in the Middle East, and former UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke will be the president's representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Senate has unanimously confirmed two more members of Obama's cabinet. New York City Housing Commissioner Sean Donovan is now the head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and Republican Ray LaHood will head the Transportation Department. The world's biggest maker of computer chips, Samsung Electronics, has recorded its first ever quarterly loss. The South Korean company declared a fourth quarter net loss of more than $16 million. And Pope Benedict is launching his own channel on the video sharing website YouTube. A Vatican spokesman says that the head of the Roman Catholic Church wants to reach out to the digital generation.
Can't wait to see that.
You can see it today.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Since August, the Congolese government has been battling rebels led by Laurent Nkunda. The fighting has displaced tens of thousands of people and left hundreds dead and homeless. This week, the Congolese government joined forces with its former arch enemy, Rwanda, shocking many not only in Africa but all over the world. They joined forces in an offensive against the rebels. And today, the Congolese government is reporting the joint force has arrested the rebel leader, Laurent Nkunda. We spoke earlier with the BBC's Africa editor, Martin Plaut, on these latest developments, and I asked him about what happened and how they found Nkunda.
What happened is that basically the Rwandans have ditched their former ally, General Laurent Nkunda, who basically had a little enclave on the border between Congo and Rwanda, and they then crossed the border, in fact, not to attack his forces, but to attack the Hutu militia, the Interahamwe, who'd been there ever since the Rwandan genocide of 1994. But when they came over the border, it's now become pretty clear there was a deal with the Congolese. you take out our enemies, we'll take out yours. So they basically first went for Lauren Kunda, who was in the town of Bunagana, which is close to the Ugandan border. He then fled to Rwanda, and the Rwandans arrested him. So that is really the state of play at the moment.
And Martin, how do you sum up the meaning of all of this? The cooperation is stunning between two formal rivals. We're talking about wars that have extended for years through the 90s between Rwanda and the Congo, and millions of people dead. Now they're joining together.
Absolutely. It is a stunning turnaround. It really, the roots of this could be seen in November last year, where the foreign ministers of both countries stood side by side in Rwanda and said, we are now going to go after the Interahamwe, the Hutu militia, who, as I said, were involved in the Rwandan genocide. So they'd struck a deal then. What we didn't know was that there was a sort of a sub-deal which said that they would also then get rid of General Nkunda at the same time. So, as I say, you know, you get rid of my rebels, I'll get rid of yours, so to speak. And General Nkunda could, at that moment, have made a deal. He could have said, yes, I'll come in with the Congolese army, which I used to be a member of, I'll be reintegrated. He didn't. He's always said that he wants to be a player, a real player in Congo. I mean, there's an interview that we have with him where he says, I'm going to march on the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. I'm going to take over the country. Now, that was absolutely impossible, but nonetheless, that was his ambition. And clearly, no one felt they could deal with him anymore, so the Rwandans essentially turned him in.
So his arrest, does that mean the end of his rebel forces? Is that threat now over?
No, his rebel forces split about a week, 10 days ago, and you know, most of them have now gone over and said they're under General Bosco Ntaganda, and he basically has said, I'll be reintegrated into the Congolese army. That took away most of Nkunda's troops, but about 2,000 of them, two battalions, are said to be still loyal to Nkunda, so we'll have to see which way they jump. But the bigger enemy is still there. The Hutu militia, the Interahamwe, are still dug in, and this, in a sense, is only stage one of the operation.
That's the BBC's Martin Plaut, the Africa editor, giving us the latest on what's happening, the latest developments, the stunning developments of Rwanda and the Congo working together.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 23rd, and Femi Okeh has some headlines for us. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. It's a rough day for markets around the world. Asian indices closed sharply lower this morning. European markets have followed the downward trend so far, and this amid news that the UK is officially in recession for the first time in more than 15 years. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich isn't known for being subtle, but a new statement is still raising eyebrows. He compares the day of his arrest to the Pearl Harbor attacks of 1941. He says that he will defeat corruption charges against him and that there's no way he'll resign. The state Senate will try him next week. Fidel Castro is hinting his days are numbered. He also wants Cuban leaders to make their own choices about the country without taking him into account. He says all this in a new column. He also praises President Obama for honesty and for closing the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. Elusive North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has apparently made a surprise appearance. North Korean and Chinese media say that he met with a Chinese diplomat today, and this is the first known meeting of this kind since August.
Any meeting of his is a surprise meeting.
Intelligence officials in the U.S. and South Korea believe that Kim had a stroke, and North Korea denies that Kim is ill. And finally, the classical music played for millions of people watching President Barack Obama's inauguration was not the live performance it appeared to be.
That was a recording?
it was a recording.
Does that mean they have to redo it in front of John Roberts?
They don't have to redo it. No. This is a little excerpt from Air and Simple Gifts.
It's beautiful.
It is.
All of the musicians actually put down their music on tape 2 days before, just in case the weather played havoc with their instruments. Now, everybody played live apart from the quartet because the weather at 30 degrees in Fahrenheit was just too chilly for them.
Oof. That sounds understandable. I do have my hand up.
You have a question?
No, we're going to move on to a listener's response because the question that we asked them today is there was this debate between President Obama and the Secret Service.
Right.
President Obama wanted to keep his BlackBerry. Mm-hmm. The Secret Service wanted to take it away. Well, President Obama won out, and we're asking if you could send them a note, what would you say?
I would say to the President, Mr. President, I love you too much. Get rid of the BlackBerry. We'll figure it out some way. Thank you.
So what would you ask him about maybe your taxes, what the puppy that the family is planning on getting, what it is, Pope Benedict perhaps, if you could send him a text, or Hugo Chavez or anyone else, give us your thoughts at 8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org.
Must be rock and roll, must be rock and roll.
Sleep Rock and Roll is the name of this tune. But, you know, if you grew up in Vladivostok, you would probably think rock and roll was in a coma. You know that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy? This fella in the Kalahari Desert has no knowledge of the world beyond, but a Coke bottle falls from the sky, and the African tribe reconstructs an entire civilization based on this one artifact. Well, that's sort of the predicament of a garage band in a place like Vladivostok, who has to rely on Japanese power rock and the occasional Blondie album that's dropped off by the people who pass through. Joining us now from Mummy Troll, which is a band that grew up in Vladivostok, is about to break into a national tour here in the United States. Lead singer Ilya Lagutenko is here in the studio. Ilya, thanks for joining us.
Very good morning to you guys.
How isolated did you feel in Vladivostok trying to make sense of the pop culture world on the edge of the Russian and Soviet continent when you grew up?
I still think it was kind of very exciting situation because my hometown, Vladivostok, was even closed for Soviet citizens to come, and you should get some kind of special visa.
So you're isolated from the Soviets?
Yeah, obviously from everyone. And we were living in a, you know, little world of, you know, boys and girls actually living on a beach because it's one of the nicest, like, beach town in far east of Russia. But at the same time, we have all those cargo ships actually coming from all over the world and, you know, unloading their stuff in a port. And all those sailors, actually, they were bringing their choice of music to town.
Right. So you had to rely on their albums.
Absolutely. Actually rely on their own choices. And how the hell actually they picked up that music, either in like everything for 100 yen box or, you know, the top charts, which they were translating, you know, from newspapers.
Well, what kind of stuff?
Hong Kong.
What kind of stuff?
I remember in my childhood, I heard everything from AC/DC to Genesis and, you know, Blondie and Kiss. And most of the music were actually judged on, you know, tapes cover or albums cover, not really for music.
Right,
because
right.
Everything traded only on black market only. And it was like ridiculously expensive. So just to compare, to get an album of, say, the band Blondie, it would cost you like 60 rubles.
Oh, that's serious.
And which is like engineer's salary was like 100 rubles. So in other words, you know, two albums a month normal.
It's a lot of your income. So you're economically isolated. But to give people a sense of where Vladivostok is, when you stand on the beach in Vladivostok and look out, you can see Sarah Palin, right? Is that true?
Actually, if you look kind of, you know, left.
Left, you can see her, yeah. Right, and it's kind of scary, isn't it?
Not really, because you don't really think about that. And when now, for instance, when we're touring California, people say, where are you from? I said, just across the ocean.
Just across the ocean from the U.S.
And we came by submarine, and people still think,
they believe you, know? You right?
Yeah. Absolutely. They said, yeah, we saw one parked, actually.
You know, this is an interesting story, though, also about the Internet and how the Internet has transformed the music business. I mean, you sort of looking through your kind of tunnel vision there in Vladivostok to try to get a sense of what rock music is, playing it it in your own band, performing live for 20 years inside Russia. And all of a sudden, the internet allows this fresh sound, this very, very different kind of sound to emerge. I mean, you're on the verge now of introducing yourselves, but there's nothing new about your sound, is there?
I would say nothing new if you think that you can afford yourself to combine different sounds from absolutely totally different genres. And we even invent our own term for our music. It's called rockapops.
Rockapops. Well, let's hear a cover that you did. It's actually on your album, Commander Ambassador and Comrade Ambassador.
Los Angeles, California снится. Сугробы до небес. Церковь я нашел на своем пути. На колени пал.
I love that. California snitza. Am I saying it right?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, which is California Dreaming, basically. I'm dreaming about California. It's one of those classic tunes which, when you translated it in other language, apparently doesn't really lose any meaning. So it's literally the same words. But when you hear it in Russian, apparently you kind of feel yourself sitting in the snow and on a winter day, obviously, yeah, on a winter day dreaming about California. So I think which is a pretty fun situation.
What do you hope audiences get from your tour? And you're actually touring in a lot of markets where the Takeaway is actually broadcast.
Yeah, tonight we're playing in New York at Irving Plaza, and then we're heading off north. And we're going to see Midwest and all the way to Seattle. We are really excited about this, our trip, because, you know, to see your country, you know, that way.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Yeah. And I tell you, the album Comrade Ambassador is a great, fresh, you know, take on a rock and roll. I love it. There's U2 references in there, all kinds of stuff. It's really great. We're going to go out on a song called Nuclear Stations. Lead singer of the band Mummy Troll is Ilya Lagutenko. Look for them in your local neighborhood. Thanks, Ilya.
Thank you.
Пора заволноваться, ощущая разряды.
That's a tough act to follow. That's some good music. They were rocking in their little isolated corner of the world.
Rushing.
I wonder if you really can see Alaska. No, let me stop. Okay. Anyhow, here's your takeaway from today.
Look, I don't think there's any conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are made by human beings. They can be resolved by human beings. And I'd stretch it to even say we might have Middle East peace before we know who the second Minnesota senator is.
That was Daniel Levy, director of the New America Foundation's Middle East Initiative on working out the conflict in the Middle East. You think it's possible? What
we,
are you going to get?
Can hope,
peace
we can hope.
Or a senator from a second senator from Minnesota?
He's California dreamer. I don't know, maybe. Minnesota dreamer.
Barack Obama is keeping his BlackBerry. He went to bat with the Secret Service, and they're letting him keep it. If you could send him one message, what would you ask him? How does he like living in the White House? What kind of dog is the family going to get?
Stimulus package, BFD.
Stimulus package, BFD, BFD.
Don't go there. Keep moving.
Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, PFA. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, one great way to annoy a scientist is to confuse science with...
Energize. Do something. We are, Doctor.
Crazy way to travel, spreading a man's molecules all over the universe.
On Star Trek, teleportation is the best way to avoid an annoying traffic jam and to bypass Klingons. But there may be real physics out there where no man has gone before. Star Trek, a reality show? on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 23rd. And hey, wait a second, John. I would be one of those people. You say teleportation. I think beam me up, Scotty.
Well, it could be possible if you're a little Adam. We'll find out.
Good morning, John, and good morning to all of you. Today, President Obama puts two serious diplomats to work on the Middle East, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we're going to take a look at Catholic schools. They're struggling around the country. We'll take a look at that. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
A stimulus summit at the White House today. President Obama hosts a bipartisan group of House and Senate leaders for talks on his proposed stimulus package. Right now, it adds up to $825 billion. Tax cuts, new spending. The package is supposed to pass by Valentine's Day. Democrats hope that, anyway. The Senate leaders huddling with the president will soon have a new colleague. Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand will take Hillary Clinton's old seat. The upstate congresswoman represents a relatively conservative district. Minnesota stuck with one senator, though, for the time being. Current count has Democrat Al Franken leading Republican Norm Coleman by 225 votes. New court ruling means a legal case challenging the count will start on Monday.
President Obama wants a strong U.S. presence in Middle East peace talks. He's naming former Senator George Mitchell special envoy for the Mideast. The president laid out how he thinks a lasting peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians could start.
Hamas must end its rocket fire. Israel will complete the withdrawal of its forces from Gaza. The United States and our partners will support a credible anti-smuggling and interdiction regime so that Hamas cannot rearm.
The United Nations wants Israel to open Gaza's borders. UN senior official Filippo Grandi says the supply shortage there is dangerous.
What we fear most is that Gaza will be kept once again in a state of semi-humanitarian crisis, never quite final, but on a lifeline type of assistance.
President Obama also named former U.N. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke as special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and we'll have more on the envoys and the challenges they face.
He's Fidel Castro in Cuba, but he's also a columnist, and he is suggesting in a column, first of all, that Barack Obama should be praised for closing the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and also that his nation should move on, that his leadership beyond him should begin soon. World markets taking a beating today. Dow futures suggest there's going to be a real bloodbath in the opening. The S&P begins trading at 827 this morning. Barack Obama is keeping his BlackBerry despite an argument with the Secret Service. Is it a security problem or is it some brand new channel of history for presidential historians? If you could text a leader, give us a text message for Barack Obama at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org or anybody. Putin, Medvedev.
I want to know how much sleep President Obama's gotten this week, so I'd send him a note.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It was a very busy day, too, for President Obama, and it meant a visit to the State Department and his newly appointed Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And while there, he signaled a new direction in U.S. foreign policy by appointing two special envoys to troubled regions, including former Northern Ireland mediator and former Senator George Mitchell to oversee Arab-Israeli issues, and longtime diplomat Richard Holbrooke to oversee Pakistan and Afghanistan relations. Mark Landler, diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times based in Washington, D.C., joins us for more with an analysis. Good morning and welcome back, Mark.
Good morning. How are you doing?
This timing is really critical, isn't it? Day two, and he's already signaled that this is a critical component of his foreign policy, those two regions, and he's put people on the job.
Absolutely. I think there was a great deal of symbolism in what the president did yesterday, and in particular in the fact that he traveled to the State Department to do this. And in addition to these appointments, He gave a speech to a room full of middle and senior level diplomats, and at the end he mingled with them and shook hands with dozens of diplomats. And I think that that was a signal he was sending, that after 8 years, during which the Pentagon in some ways emerged as the primary agent for international operations for the U.S., that he really wants the State Department to have a more central, a more robust role. And that was clearly the signal he was sending.
And, Mark, let's talk about the two individuals that he's put at the head of these missions, George Mitchell as Middle East envoy. What's been the reaction to that?
Well, almost uniformly positive. George Mitchell is, of course, known for his work in helping to broker a ceasefire in Northern Ireland, not a ceasefire, a peace agreement, I should say. And he's also led a fact-finding commission that looked into causes of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. He did that for former President Clinton. Of course, he was well known as heading the commission that looked into steroids and those issues in baseball as well. So here's a man who has a wide range of experience, probably as much as you're ever going to find, an unquestioned record for fairness, for being judicious and thoughtful, and also very even-handed. And that's seen as important in the Middle East, where occasionally the rap on the United States has been that the United States is so close to Israel that sometimes it's not perceived as being as effective a broker as it could be. George Mitchell does not have that problem at all.
And that was certainly the rap on the Bush administration.
That was very much the rap on the Bush administration. Not that the people that the Bush administration had involved in the process were not also effective, honest, and good people, but generally they were identified as being very close to Israel. And in the case of Mr. Mitchell, he's really viewed as a very even-handed guy. And I think the response to him will be generally positive. And he's going to go to the region within a week or so. And so the Obama administration is going to be off to a very quick start.
And Richard Holbrooke.
Richard Holbrooke, likewise, has a very long record. He was a critical player in the Dayton Peace Accord, which brought an end to the war in Bosnia, one of the most experienced American diplomats still active. Also a man with an extremely strong personality, endless reserves of energy, very creative in his approach. And I think that's important because as tough as the Arab-Israeli issue is, the portfolio that Holbrooke has been handed is even more difficult. Pakistan and Afghanistan, which encompasses both the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda, which continues to be in those frontier areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then lastly, the fact that the Pakistanis, of course, have a nuclear program. So he's got a whole range of extremely complicated issues, and he's a tough-minded guy, and I think the reaction to him is positive as well.
Okay, that's just day two, and then there'll be day three and day four and day five. Mark Landler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Mark Landler is a diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times based in Washington. He was talking about President Obama's two special envoys.
Well, also on the agenda is the $825 billion stimulus plan that is making its way through Congress. Joining us now is Scott Garrett, U.S. Representative from New Jersey, a Republican, ranking member of the Subcommittee on Capital Markets, Insurance, and Government-Sponsored Enterprises. And that title there gives you a sense of the complexity of both the financial industry right now and the stimulus package. It's a subcommittee of the House Financial Services Committee. Scott Garrett, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Yeah, we like to give our titles real long names.
So. Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, it used to be that government-sponsored enterprises were pretty much Freddie and Fannie Mae, but now it's much, much bigger. It seems like your jurisdiction is advancing by billions of dollars per day, Congressman Garrett.
That's an interesting analysis, actually. You're right that it used to just be the GSEs as being the government-sponsored enterprises, but now that we basically all but nationalized the banks, you might put all of them in that category as well because they're all sponsored by the government.
Now, you want to reverse that trend. That's basically your point, you have an uphill battle fighting what appears to be a very strong Democratic consensus to push this forward.
Oh, absolutely. We want to push back against the tide in this case. I was one who was with, I guess, the minority who said the original TARP program was not well conceived and thought out, and now TARP 2 was also not well conceived and thought out either because, as you know, we basically just gave another $350 billion away still without any plan on how to spend it.
Now, I would say, Congressman Garrett, that you were right on the accountability issue in the sense mm-hmm. that the TARP just sort of floated out into the ether. But do you think that you're right on the economics issue in the sense that there is a crisis here and there's some sort of stimulus that's necessary? What would you do short of nothing?
Well, I think it's not just me. I'm just reading as I waited to come on the program and no new economist report on the situation. And it's yes, there is certainly a difficult economic situation here, not just in the United States, but globally as well. We all agree on that. What is we disagree with is on the methodology to deal with it. Now, part of the problem is that you have had just so many different programs thrown out there almost every week or so. Both the Treasury and the Fed keeps on, I'll say, almost changing course, that it creates so much uncertainty in the marketplace that investors are doing the same thing they did, I hate to refer back to, but during the Great Depression, and that is to say, we don't know what the government is going to do next, so I am not going to invest in my business or in any other business growth until everything settles down.
Well, you've certainly seen that with the banks. I mean, the bank stocks are going to zero as the feds acquire more and more preferred stock, making the common stock essentially worthless. But what would you do to clarify the situation? I mean, Congressman Garrett, step in and make it all clear.
Well, a couple things. One thing is, as far as your opening comment with regard to the overall stimulus and what have you, we have thrown out an idea in a form of legislation of an economic stimulus and growth plan, and that goes basically counter to both what the House did and what President Obama is talking about as far as stimulus, and that is to reinvigorate the investment market, reinvigorate the business climate, and that is a number of different things. It's incentivizing businesses through lowering the capital gains, lowering the corporate tax, Section 179 and spending, which basically tells businesses go out there today and start spending, and you will be rewarded by a deductibility today as opposed to over a long term.
Although, and Congressman Garrett, let's talk about that for just a moment. Doesn't that make the same mistake that the Bush administration made on the stimulus package in the sense that you can give the banks money, but you can't force them to lend? You can give small businesses capital gains tax breaks, but you can't force them to invest.
Interesting. It could, I guess, but you'd have a better upside and you would have a better potential for long-term job growth than what's being talked about right now. You know, the stimulus that's the $800 billion or whatever it turns out to be at the end of the day, plan basically is saying let's create jobs, and jobs is defined as anything as simple as, I think down in Miami or Florida someplace, hiring somebody to install a light bulb, or up in Vermont someplace, buy a street sweeper, things that will may only last for a day or a week or a month. We're talking about how do you actually try to encourage the economy to grow by creating not just jobs, careers that will be here today, tomorrow, and hopefully a year from now, and not be and not continuously be funded by the government as well.
All right. Well, Congressman, that sounds a little bit like Barack Obama's infrastructure program in the sense that we're spending money to get jobs, to do things that actually need to be done. You just would focus it on small businesses. Am I right about that?
No, not necessarily small businesses, but just one second on what he's talking about, infrastructure. You know, out of the entire $800-plus billion, although he sort of emphasizes infrastructure, only 3% is actually for roads and bridges. So there's a misconception by what they're spending and what the public reads as far as that program is concerned. It's just a drop in the bucket, total dollars. And actually, the amount of money, CBO just said this the other day, the total amount of money that can actually be spent this fiscal year on that program, I think, is only, around $30 billion of it, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it's even a fraction of that, actually, come to think of it.
All right, well, we'll be looking for your voice to shout loud and clear over the overwhelming Democratic majority there in the House as the debate on the stimulus package proceeds. Congressman Garrett, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate the chance. Good morning.
Scott Garrett is the ranking Republican member of the Subcommittee on Capital Markets, Insurance, and Government-Sponsored Enterprises on the same committee, Financial Services, as Barney Frank. Thanks so much.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It appears this week that President Obama won his debate with the Secret Service, and he's getting to keep his BlackBerry.
Now, LOL.
LOL, exactly. Lots of laugh, lots of love, all those things. Anyhow, if you were one of the very few people who are going to make it to that list of people allowed to email the president, what would you text to him? Would you say, you know, hey, Prez, how you doing? How'd your day go? What would you say? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Joe Biden, TMI. Well, there's only one story on Wall Street this morning, actually two if you're looking at the tanking Dow and S&P futures. But yesterday, John Thane was ousted in a scandalous palace coup at Bank of America, a bank whose stock is in very serious trouble. Thane, you may recall, was the head of Merrill Lynch, which was bought by Bank of America. He's now a co-executive, or was yesterday, a co-executive at B of A. But in another sign of huge Wall Street management shifts, Citigroup brought in a new chairman a few days ago, Richard Parsons, former chairman of Time Warner. Louise Story joins us now to explain what seems to be a real changing of the financial guard. She's a reporter for the New York Times and covers Wall Street. Louise Story, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's talk about the Thane story. John Thane used to be called Mr. Fix-It when he was running the New York Stock Exchange, came in after Grasso and his scandal over pay compensation, then went to Merrill Lynch after things sort of went sour there. He apparently was instrumental in negotiating the deal that allowed Bank of America to purchase Merrill Lynch. Now he's out. What's going on here?
Part of what you're seeing going on is just the closing of a merger. So people always leave companies after mergers, and that's part of what you're seeing. What you're also seeing, however, is information about John Thane trickling out, and perhaps he's let his guard down a little because he's no longer in charge and he's no longer running the company. One of the biggest signs that we saw that there was a little more to John Thane than we knew was that he was pushing for a bonus last fall when every other chief of Wall Street knew that in this environment and when they'd taken taxpayer money, it really would be tone deaf to take a bonus, but yet he was still pushing for one.
And not only for him, but for other people at Merrill, he was sort of pushing those bonuses as Merrill was being sold to Bank of America. And the head of Bank of America suggested yesterday that as many as $41 billion in Merrill Lynch losses were somehow concealed or possibly not disclosed to Bank of America as it was negotiating the purchase.
There are disclosure issues here. We'll have to wait and see what is proven. One of the issues is how bad are Merrill's assets, and because a lot of the write-downs are still coming from toxic assets from years ago, and as long as it can be shown that Merrill used good models to estimate them last fall, it would be difficult to prove that they maliciously made a mistake. But there certainly will be investigations.
You know, this appears to have come very much at, you know, suddenly. I mean, CNBC broke the story and had documents yesterday talking about John Thane redoing his office to the tune of $800,000 or more. And it appears that on Wednesday, John Thane bought 84,000 shares of B of A stock at about $5.70 a share. You wouldn't think somebody on their way out would buy stock in Bank of America if they were going to be fired. How sudden was this?
I think it was fairly sudden for John. Most of his top deputies who worked for him at Merrill Lynch quit in recent weeks, and in some ways people said that made him look like he had more power and that he'd be staying around longer because some of his deputies might have been competition and they all quit. However, after the fourth quarter earnings announcement and the capital infusion a week ago, Ken Lewis was coming under a lot of fire for buying Merrill Lynch and paying as much as it did. And I think that in part this is as a deflection of criticism away from Ken Lewis and his responsibility for the deal, on to John Boehner.
Ken Lewis, of course, the head of Bank of America. Let's talk about Dick Parsons taking over as chairman of Citigroup. You know, one of the things that's been talked about in the reporting here is his connection to Barack Obama, apparently was on the transition team, and that they are close in some sense. Does the ascension of Richard Parsons to the head of Citigroup signal a kind of new management agenda on Wall Street as this financial crisis takes hold in the banking industry?
Certainly, the money is in Washington today. That's where the power is. That's where the money is. It used to be in New York. So his connections are important, and there's many people who think that the government is playing a larger role than we know in the management of Citigroup and possibly now in the management of Bank of America. With these second rounds of investment from the government is taking over more control. At Citigroup, the thing to ask, though, is why are they changing people on their board? You know, Robert Rubin was an advisor, and he left, and now they have a new chairman. Some people wonder why they're not changing people on their management team. However, their CEO, of course, was not a CEO when the mortgage investments were undertaken. You know, he came in afterwards, just like John Thain came in afterwards to Merrill. Nonetheless, Citigroup is still very troubled.
And the question there, I guess, is will Vikram Pandit, who is the chief executive officer at Citigroup, retain his post? What's the sort of feeling? I mean, he's you know, up and down day to day, like the stock at Citigroup.
People know that he's very smart and that he, you know, is trying very hard. Some of his upper management team and observers and analysts are watching and wondering, you know, if he inspires enough confidence. However, there aren't many other people to put in the job, and so whoever is making these decisions, whether it be the board or the government, has to look at who could replace him. And for years, the bench in Wall Street's been a little weak, so it's unclear if he's going to be pulled out right now.
Yeah, who wants to run a bank these days? Louise Story, thanks so much, reporter for the New York Times. And she's a Wall Street reporter. And with Wall Street News, we got Femi Okeh.
Hello there. Good morning. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Just waiting for Wall Street to open. Have actually had some very bad news from the UK, where they officially are in a recession. And the world market's also closing down low for Asia today. Democratic Congresswoman Kirsten Gillibrand is the New York governor's pick to fill Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's vacant Senate seat. An aide to the governor says that Gillibrand will be formally named later today. The Senate has scheduled a vote on Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary's nomination for Monday. President Barack Obama's nominee for Attorney General Eric Holder, however, may not even get a committee hearing before Tuesday. That's amid concerns about his views on interrogation methods used on detainees. And President Obama is vowing to find both a new course in Afghanistan and to help Israel achieve peace with the Arab world. To help with Afghanistan and Pakistan, the president has named former UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke as a special coordinator of US policy there. And our partner, the New York Times, has a lead story today about the emergence of a former Guantanamo Bay detainee as al-Qaeda's second in command in Yemen. That's a look at some stories making news this morning.
That's what life after Gitmo, it means. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We're talking about presidential technology, sort of, anyhow. Barack Obama wanted to keep his BlackBerry. The Secret Service said, we don't think so. But in the end, he won out. And so we're just wondering, if you were on that very short list of people, very, very short list, who could actually send a text to Barack Obama,
yeah,
what would you say to him?
Yeah.
How would that start? Dear Mr. President, Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Would you send him a smiley?
A smiley?
A presidential smiley. Yes, they'll have to create a whole new archive for presidential smileys now. So in joining us in the studio is Brian Greene, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University, who has teleported himself down here from Columbia University from uptown. Or did you just take a cab?
I just took a cab. I wish I could have teleported.
Yes. Well, Brian Greene, of course, knows everything about physics. He actually wears a sign on his shirt, "Ask me about super string theory." He can explain, best-selling author, explains to us everything from expanding universes to quantum mechanics. And Brian, I'm going through my issue of the journal Science, okay, and here's this article, Quantum Teleportation Between Distant Matter Qubit. It's published this week in the journal Science. It talks about teleportation, and of course I'm thinking, beam me up, Scotty, get me around the traffic jam, take me down to the planet. But in fact, teleportation is actually something that relates very directly to quantum theory. What have they demonstrated in this paper?
What they've done in this paper is demonstrated that you can actually take information that's located at one point and cause it to reappear at a distant point, strangely enough, without actually traveling between the two points.
So quantum theory, of course, creates this ambiguity between the hard matter, you know, that we think of as, you know, atoms and molecules, and this sort of ethereal sort of information quality of matter, which isn't maybe hard, but if it moves from place to place, it actually has properties that suggest things like teleportation. How important is this discovery?
Well, it's very important, and it really carries on a series of discoveries that take us all the way back to the early part of the 20th century, mm-hmm. where we learned that to describe how small things operate, atoms, molecules, subatomic particles, we need a whole new framework. The ideas of Newton just don't work when you apply them to small things. Newton works well for baseballs, for right. planets, for stars, but his math just fails when you apply it to tiny things.
Can we just back up just a little bit? When you say information from A to Z and skipping all the letters in between, what do you mean information? Are you talking about things? Are you talking about those molecules? Are you talking about what? I mean, I sent an email from this computer. It ends up in my cousin's in Nigeria.
Well,
it's not going through anything. It's just sort of flipping over.
Well, in every more familiar context where something travels from one point to another, it has to traverse the intervening space. You know, you throw a baseball from first base to third base, it goes across the field. But one of the weirdnesses of quantum physics, really discovered by Albert Einstein, is that there's a way in which two distant objects can correlate their behaviors. They can act identically without communicating in any conventional sense. So the example that perhaps brings it home, if you have a pair of dice,
right.
you throw one in Las Vegas, the other in Atlantic City, you expect the numbers to come up randomly, 3 in Las Vegas, you know, 4 in Atlantic City, and so forth. If you have a pair of quantum dice and you throw them in exactly the same way, they can be set up so that if it comes out 1 in Las Vegas, it'll come out 1 in Atlantic City. Hmm. 4 in Las Vegas, 4 in Atlantic City. They correlate their behaviors without there being any communication in any conventional sense between them.
All right, so let me quiz you here, or let me get myself quizzed here. Professor, I'm doing my orals now, all right? Does that mean that quantum theory suggests that matter is actually interacting in a way that doesn't require space, and if that's the case, we can somehow utilize that interaction as a way to go from here to there without actually having to travel?
Yeah, A plus. I mean, that's exactly how I would summarize it. What we learn from quantum physics is that space is not what we think it is, right? Space is normally that which creates separation and independence. Quantum physics can bridge space in a way where objects that are far apart act as though they are next to each other.
Okay, so does this paper suggest a way in which distant pieces of matter can actually use that sort of theoretical quantum interaction network to get from point A to point B?
Yes, that's basically right. So I should say that there are previous works which already showed that this phenomenon of quantum teleportation, where distant objects make use of this connection to allow information to go from place to place instantaneously, this paper shows that you can do it with atoms, where previously it was really done with photons or individual particles like electrons.
So we're working up.
It scales it up, and it also makes the distance between the objects larger. Previously it had been done for objects quite close together. These atoms are a meter apart, which on the scale of atoms is huge.
A meter apart for atoms, that's big.
That's like a universe.
So molecules is next. then you could get to something maybe as big as Adora's shoes.
Well, that's the natural question.
Just one pair.
Well, that's the natural question. If you can teleport information that's stored in an atom to another distant atom, can you scale it up and really do what they did in Star Trek? Can you beam, you know, Kirk from the planet? And unfortunately, I just don't see any way that these approaches can be scaled up to the level of people. It's just too complicated.
Right. Well, that's a big, big step for another paper. Brian Greene, thanks so much for helping to explain that to us. Teleportation. He's a professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University, best-selling author. Brian, thanks for teleporting yourself into the studio.
Thank you.
Be gone, sir.
Crazy way to travel, spreading a man's molecules all over the universe.
And we're going to beam down to Planet Femi for a moment with the headlines.
Are you sure you want to visit Planet Femi?
Yes.
Good morning, then. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The markets are open. While I read the next story, John, can you just check to see how we're doing out there?
You mean on the markets?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're down about 2% at this point on the Dow, but I'd give it another 10 minutes before we can establish a real trend.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you for doing that. The world's biggest maker of computer chips, Samsung Electronics, has recorded its first ever quarterly loss. The South Korean company declared a fourth quarter net loss of more than $16 million. Crafting an economic stimulus package on Capitol Hill has not been smooth going. Some key elements of the package have been passed by a party line vote in the House, and Republican leaders say that Democratic talk of bipartisanship is looking insincere. A new computer worm is hitting the internet. The malicious software program is known as Configure or DownADUP, and it's spread by a vulnerability in Microsoft Windows. Now, it spreads through USB and memory devices like USB drives or MP3 players.
It's filthy things.
And it's believed to have infected millions of personal and business computers in what seems to be the first step of a multi-stage attack. And so the Mac versus PC gang on the News Hub were actually having a little debate about.
Boy, do people feel strongly about that. Either you're a Mac or you're a PC person.
Yes.
Well, some people are healthy and other people are, you know, they live recklessly.
That applies. That's a good analogy to the PC Mac debate.
Okay, time out. Please be quiet in the studio. The movie Slumdog Millionaire had its Mumbai premiere last night. The director Danny Boyle's thank you speech, of course, included the city and the people of Mumbai, who features so prominently in the film.
All of the film, to my mind, is from this city, this extraordinary city, and I go on and on and on about it because I don't want anybody to miss out our debt of gratitude to it.
Open tonight in Mumbai. We could go see that movie.
Very, very exciting. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and we're going to be talking Oscars.
Oscars.
Right? Because not long ago, the biggest entertainment, of course, about Oscars, at least for some of us, was watching these big budget studio movies duke it out for awards with these little tiny low budget indie underdogs.
Titanic has the record for Oscars, right? It's the biggest budget of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
The world has changed. The world has changed.
But that's not so much anymore. Because so many of the movies that we're looking at in 2009 as potential Oscar winners are small.
Little pictures.
They're little pictures. Stories. And the carpet blogger for the New York Times, David Carr, is joining us now from Los Angeles, where it's very early in the morning there. David is also a media and culture columnist and author of The Night of the Gun, a reporter who investigates the darkest story of his life. And he's here to talk about this year's Oscars. So there's not going to be any big lavish parties lobbying the Academy based on the movies that are facing the movies that have been nominated for an Oscar.
I think there's going to be a ton of lavish parties. There's always a bull market in ego out here. There are signs everywhere. When it comes to going for Oscar, financial reason doesn't usually come into play very often, and this year's no exception.
Well, let's talk about the movies that have been nominated for Best Picture. Frost Nixon, that's made $8 million at the box office. Milk, $20 million. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, $103 million. The Reader, $7 million. And Slumdog Millionaire, $43 million. I wouldn't exactly call them big blockbusters.
Well, it's been a while since a bunch of big blockbusters flooded out. The theory is, and it's only a theory, is that if you go get that little statue in your hand, you can wander out into the marketplace and people will flock to see your picture, not only in the theater, but then your DVD will have huge value going forward. That's the theory.
But what does it say that the Academy picked so many movies that come from smaller production companies versus some of the blockbuster? Are they rewarding innovation, new ideas? What's happening?
I think this has been a trend if you go back to Crash, where you have movies that maybe don't have the financial pedigree, but they've got significant artistic pedigree. This was a year where both big studios and independents who funded really good directors and then got out of the way, did very well. If you notice, all the best pictures were also matched by best directors. And then you have teeny tiny little movies like Frozen River and The Visitor, which many of your listeners probably haven't seen. They should, by the way, that were made for, you know, the kind of money that wouldn't pay the craft services budget on Batman and are in the thick of things. Melissa Leo got nominated for Frozen River, Richard Jenkins for The Visitor, and it's partly because they had wonderful directors who were allowed to execute what they wanted to do.
So, David, what would you call the Oscars this year? 2009 is the year of X, fill in the blank.
Oh, boy, that's tough. I think it was a bouncy year, actually, in terms of if you look at Button, if you look at Slumdog, even though they've got, you know, dark parts to them, they're fundamentally hopeful and light. I think the Academy's reacting to the times and saying, you know, let's look forward and maybe the sun's coming up.
The sun is coming up. David Carr, thank you for joining us.
Oh, an absolute pleasure to speak.
I like that. The sun is coming up. David Carr, the carpetbagger blogger for the New York Times, where he's also a media and culture columnist and author of The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life. And he was talking about the Oscars and all the low-budget Indian movies nominated this year.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 23rd, and Femi Oke has the headlines of the morning.
Hello there. The time is 30 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is set to strike down a controversial Bush administration rule. New reports say that the president will lift a ban on U.S. funding of global family planning groups that are involved with abortion. And this meant that many groups providing contraception assistance and other family planning counseling lost out on funds. Now watch out for some stimulating bipartisan conversation at the White House today. President Obama hosts congressional leaders from both parties to talk about his economic stimulus proposal. The package has new spending and tax cuts, and Democrats want to pass it by the middle of next month. President Obama is tapping two top diplomats to step up efforts in global hotspots. Former Senator George Mitchell will be the Middle East special envoy. A lasting peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians will be his top priority. And former UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke will serve as a special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's a new reminder of how tough Holbrooke's job is going to be. Seven are dead in Pakistan near the Afghan border. It appears to be a US missile strike on militants there, and there have been many such attacks recently. But this is the first under President Obama's watch.
Yeah, Holbrooke's going to have a rough time, I have a feeling.
And finally, a team of British and Italian scientists want to dig up the body of the 16th century astronomer Galileo. They say that looking at his DNA will help them work out if and how Galileo's poor eyesight affected his research. Dr. Peter Watson is hoping to get a look at Galileo's corpse.
He suffered from a very serious number of diseases while he was alive. He was also totally blind for at least the last 2, if not 3 years. He stopped his actual telescopic observations 3 years before he died. And the cause of that blindness has never been really discovered.
Now, the remains of Galileo are resting in a church in Florence, and the scientists are at the moment discussing his being exhumed with that church.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Another headline this week is that the Catholic Archdiocese of Miami announced the closing of 6 schools, while in Brooklyn, 11 Catholic schools are set to close, too. It's part of a trend across the country, with many other schools already closed or in the process of shuttering. Catholic schools are failing as enrollment plunges, though in a few places, enrollment is actually on the rise. So why are so many failing and some are succeeding? That's the question, and to help us answer that is Brenda Becker, a writer from Brooklyn whose daughter has spent 9 years in Catholic schools, and also Bob Vobril, the superintendent of schools for the Catholic Diocese of Wichita, Kansas. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Brenda, I'm going to start with you. Lay out some of the issues that you believe are affecting Catholic schools and really contributing to the downward spiral of enrollment.
Well, starting from first principles, if you are a believing Catholic, this system is very important to you because it literally creates the next generation of Catholics. Ours is a challenging faith. It's the single most effective way. And these are also schools that are the heart and soul of their parishes, their communities. So my question is, if we're literally on a mission from God, then why haven't our church leaders, our bishops, been acting more like the Blues Brothers, doing the backflips down the middle of the church, dancing on the diner counter?
There's a vision.
Doing anything they can to make the system work. And instead, the management style that I've seen has been right up there with a bunch of Chrysler executives in terms of nimbleness, innovation, vision. How hard have they really tried?
And Bob, how do you respond to that kind of criticism?
How can you respond? I think that Catholic schools in the United States are at a crossroads. I agree with that. And I think the choice is whether Catholic schools will be an instrument to form young people in faith or whether they will continue to go down a road where only the upper middle income and upper class can afford to be a part of Catholic schools. And obviously, I would hope that Catholic schools would choose to be primarily a mission of the church to form kids in the faith.
But Bob, the bottom line is the cost of Catholic schools and certainly the economy are contributing factors, but the Catholic Church really has some serious challenges in front of it. You're dealing with the aftermath of the sexual abuse scandal, and there is this disillusionment that me being growing up in a Catholic household, I hear a lot from Catholics, and you read about it a lot, that many feel that the church was slow to react to changes in society and that the church has been unwilling to admit problems, and that has discouraged Catholic families from sending their children to Catholic schools.
I don't find that in the middle of the country. What I find is that for most people, the Catholic Church is their parish. And so in our mind here, we feel that if the parish is providing good service to the families of the parish, and in our case at least providing Catholic education for those families, then the issues that are facing the world at large or the church at large don't press as heavily on them. Because they see.
But let me just stop you right there, though. But how do you explain then enrollment in 1960 was 5.2 million students? In 2008, it was 2 million students.
Do we have about 2 days to answer that question?
But how would you sum that up?
Well, I think the main challenge that today's families face is that in 1960 or in the 50s when I was in grade school, the teachers were all sisters, and a Catholic education was affordable for everybody. Today, the cost of an education is in our world here, $4,000 to $5,000 for elementary schools, and $8,000 to $10,000 for high schools, and no family can afford to pay the full cost of that themselves.
And let's bring Brenda into this conversation because you have a child in the schools. Is it just about the money, Brenda?
I am so not sold on that excuse. Here in New York City, we're told parents can't afford the tuition. We have two different options besides Catholic schools. One is free, that's the public schools, and one is our private schools, which cost about $30,000 a year. And there's what I call the lawn chair scenario. We've all seen it on the news. People are camping out in pup tents at midnight to get online for a new public charter school, to line up to register for some pricey private school with a huge waiting list. So is there no demand for something in the middle? Of course there is.
So what is Bob not addressing, Brenda, that you would like answers to?
Well, our Brooklyn Diocese is calling their program of shutting down the schools preserving the vision. It's an Orwellian term that implies that they're strengthening them for the future. But what they're actually doing is preserving a vision, to me, of the 1950s, when the parents were Irish and Italian, the families were big, the nuns worked for free, and all was good. Well, that's not the product, and that's not the world anymore. So innovate. If you're on a mission from God, figure out what's going to work for tomorrow. People are hungry for the message. They're hungry for the product. What are they doing wrong that they're not making it work? And the answer is they're not doing much of anything except just waiting around like Starbucks. Oops, we opened too many. Better
shut
them down.
And we're going to let Bob respond to that. But actually, Bob, you are involved down there in Wichita in an innovative program of trying to recruit new students. Would you say this is your way of addressing this changing environment that we live in?
Well, we believe that at the heart of this question is whether it is the parish's responsibility to provide for a Catholic education or whether it's the responsibility of the individual family to fund the whole thing. And we believe, really, I agree with Brenda, to the extent that Catholic schools are the best way to provide a Catholic education for young people. And if that's true, then a church has a vested interest in making that education available and affordable to as many families as possible.
And do you think that the church has made that a priority? Have Catholic schools made that a priority and expressed that to those communities? I mean, there are almost 65 million Catholics in the United States. Has that been expressed to the entire Catholic community?
Yes, the bishops have made two statements in the last 20 years as a conference, saying that Catholic schools are the best means available for the education of young people. But where most dioceses face challenges is how to fund the education if the families themselves can't.
And so really for you, it certainly does boil down to some funding issues. And Brenda, I'm going to let you have the final word here quickly.
I think the system has to be economically diverse. If they buffed up the product, they'd pull in upper-middle-class parents, and they could support more scholarships because every upper-middle-class parent wants to say their kid sits next to a poor kid.
Thanks for joining us, Brenda. Brenda Becker is a writer. Her daughter has spent 9 years in Brooklyn Catholic schools. And Bob, thank you. Bob Vobrill is superintendent of schools for the Catholic Diocese in Wichita, Kansas.
You know, I'm going to give Brenda the last word on the show.
If they buffed up the product, they'd pull in upper-middle-class parents, and they could support more scholarships because every upper-middle-class parent wants to say their kid sits next to a poor kid.
That's Brenda Becker talking about what's a poor diocese to do. She's a writer from Brooklyn whose daughter has spent 9 years in Catholic schools. Barack Obama is keeping his BlackBerry. Going to text him?
Hi, my name is Walter. I'm from New York. And if I could text message the new president, I would say, if you're reading this from me, then you should get a new BlackBerry, or if you get an iPhone, you'll have a lot more fun.
Fabulous. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. TMI. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
LOL.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.